Now, we've been talking about Philippians, and my one nugget is my own. Do something great, learn to be small. And I want to do something great for Jesus. So I know that I have to learn to be small so that he can be big. And carrying that theme from chapter 2, I'd love to spend this hour in chapter 3 and talk about spiritual intimacy. That's an art. Spiritual intimacy with God is an art, and an art needs to be learned. Let me bring you back to that idea. It's a spiritual art to be humble. It's a spiritual art to be content. It's a spiritual art to love. And we cannot do this without the Spirit. I mean, that to me is very obvious, but I need to remember that and remind myself of that. But as we come into chapter 3, we learn about Paul, who knew the Lord so well, and yet he said, I want to know him more. I want to go deeper. I want to go to the next level. And I would like to think that if you do not have that yearning in your heart, you begin to pray for it. Just ask God, give me a hunger to know you more, so I can hardly stand it, so that I am pressured into knowing you more. And more and more. The little book that I've just finished that follows God's front door is called The Deep Place Where Nobody Goes, and it's more conversations with the Lord on the steps of my soul. And as I was writing that book, or gleaning from my own diaries thoughts to put into it, I realized that I have this horrible, frightening choice every day of my life. Every day of my life, I had this choice to know him more. And you can know him more any minute of any day. And I ask God again for this hunger, this ravening hunger that God has placed, not all the time, but many times in my heart, to go to a level I've never been in prayer, to understand his word as I've never seen it lit up before, to become a blessing, to grace people around me even without saying a word, as Christ's Spirit so fills my life, as I take him with me. He has no option. We take Christ with us. He lives within us. And allow him to influence people around me without me even knowing it. That's what he wants. I mean, if God is living in all his fullness in you, shouldn't people know about that? Shouldn't they sense it? Shouldn't they feel it? Of course. How could it be otherwise? And yet they don't. And Paul says, I just want to know him more. The fellowship of his sufferings. To be made like him. And to die. To be like him in his death. I want to die, he says, in the right sense. Make sure you've had that funeral I was talking about. I am crucified with Christ. Well, what's the body doing lying around? Bury it. Just get rid of that. And say to God, now help me, nevertheless I live, yet not I, but Christ lives in me. And so I can't stay there because I want to get into chapter 4. And I want to talk about a spiritual art, which is the peace of God. It's a spiritual art not to worry, to know peace of mind and heart, to live relaxed, content. It's a spiritual art, and it must be learned. And how can you learn it without something to worry about? It's impossible. I mean, if you're going to practice, then you've got to have something to worry about. And so God says, well, I will provide that for you. I will give you workshops, little workshops. Just this last year, I've had many sort of minor things in my travels to worry about. And I've had to remember, oh, okay, it's a seminar. Sitting in a jail. That was amazing. In India. Because somebody had stolen everything out of my bag in the immigration hall. And they wouldn't believe me. And they said, no, you lost it. And I said, no, everything's stolen. My two passports, my tickets, my money, my everything. It's gone. And it began a nightmare 3 weeks for me, trying to get in the country and then trying to get out the country. And I didn't do anything I went to do. Very frustrating, very puzzling. Usually I know why these things happen because I meet someone or, you know, or I learn the big lesson, and I'm still trying to figure out the India thing. But one thing I do know, oh, it's a workshop. I hate this. Why do you do this to me? So you want me to learn how to be at peace, you know, sitting in this jail with a guy manacled to the wall by my side, I want you to know, as I wrote out my report for the police and tried to convince them that I hadn't lost the stuff, that I'd been robbed. And that was quite an experience. Could I know the peace of God? Well, I knew it in measure. I didn't do very well for some of those days and in that 3 weeks. But I tell you something, the more you practice, the better you get at it. So learn it quick. That's my method. You know, I don't need the pain. And so I want to learn quick so that I can get out of the workshop and graduate. I suppose we'll never graduate till we get to heaven. So the peace of God depends, obviously, with peace with God. I mean, you've got to have made your peace with God. He's got to have made his peace with you and forgiven you, walked into your heart and life and made himself at home, settled down in your heart. That's where peace begins. And of course, it depends on Christ and his reconciling work. He is our peace. Christ is my peace. He was always at peace. Look at him through the Gospels. Not that he didn't weep, he did. Not that he wasn't frustrated with people. He was frustrated with his disciples one day. He came out of a wonderful quiet time with his father and chatting to Moses and Elijah, comes down the mountain and hears his disciples, and they say, "We could not." That frustrates him. "We could not." And he said, "How long must I be with you? You're driving me crazy." I'm so glad that happened, because it shows me that Christ dealt with frustration. He was frustrated. He was upset. He was disappointed in people, just like we get. But the peace in his heart never moved. That was a given. And so the frustration was on the surface, like the ocean. It was deep, deep, deep peace inside. So of course you're going to be frustrated. Of course you're going to have pain and all these things. But God wants to show us how to let it be on the top. And deep, 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 deep inside, in the deep place where nobody goes, not in the shallow place where everyone lives. This is where Christ wants to give us the power of his presence in such impact that the waves on the top can do what they like. The stillness in my heart. The peace of God. And it passes understanding. You can't explain it to anybody. The peace of God is ultimate spiritual contentment. It's a learned art to let this peace settle our worried hearts. But I have learned and am learning in whatsoever state I am, even a worried state, to be content. Can I learn peace when I have concerns? Because there's concern and worry. Paul said, every day I have the concern of all the churches. And that's what we're going to have to deal with. But how do I turn an obsessive worry into a manageable concern? And I have to learn that, especially in the ministry. Because not only do you have your own worries, you have the worries of that other family we talked about, the church family, don't you? And you're going to be absolutely broken with this if you don't learn what to do with all the concerns and worries that come your way. So tranquility is a learned art. You can't learn it unless you have something to worry about. Now, biblical peace is not the absence of conflict, but peace while conflict is raging. When I was speaking about Jesus in the storm, I wrote a little poem at the end of that sermon, and it says, the last verse, "In the sudden squalls that swamp me, and the waves of sin and strife, whipped by winds that are against me as I nearly drown in life, come and roar and blow and batter, and the devil does his part. Nothing will my spirit shatter. There is stillness in my heart." I want to do that. I want to know it. And I can't know it unless he allows worries to come to test and to train me. In fact, in Hebrews it says, hardship is the trainer. If you're running the race, you have a trainer. What is the trainer? Suffering. Hardship. is the trainer. And incidentally, I was told in the East from somebody that knows very well what they're talking about, you people in the West get hardship and inconvenience mixed up. And that's absolutely true. And I come back from these incredible situations God allows me the privilege of being in, and I hear Christians in America talking about inconvenience and calling it hardship. It's sheer inconvenience. And they're on hardship, and they call that inconvenience, amazingly. For example, we were in a restricted country teaching, and the religious police found out where we were. And so our leader said, now, you're supposed to be tourists. And we had a team of about six of us in there. And so you're going to have to play tourist tomorrow because they're going to be watching us. And so we're going to go on a boat around these islands and dress like tourists, bring your camera, and we'll see if they come, which they will, around. Then they'll see we're just being tourists and they'll leave us alone and maybe we can get together again at the end of the week. And so we arrive at 8 o'clock to get on the boat, and I look around and there's about 80 other tourists. And I said to my husband, you know, they look awfully familiar. And Stuart said, Jill, it's all the people that we had yesterday dressed up like tourists. And surely it was our seminar of pastors and their wives who were looking very much like tourists and behaving very much like tourists. And we all got on the boat, and there wasn't anybody else on the boat but us. And when we were out in the water, our interpreter said, now, Stuart, you were at Ephesians 2:10 yesterday. Please continue. It's Ephesians 2:11. And so without a Bible and without notes, because, of course, we couldn't let one of those show, he began to teach and teach. And then we got to an island. We got off. She said, now, this is a watched island, and so just pretend we're having lunch. Some of you go swimming. Don't let a Bible show. Don't get a pencil and notes out. And let's have a happy time. And as we stand around and eat lunch, Stuart, you were at Ephesians 3, verse 2. Please continue. And so he taught a few more verses, and we got back on the boat. And that's how we spent one of the most glorious days of my life. Now then, as a result of that, there were 300 churches in that country. All but three were shut down. Because they found us, one of those three was shut down. The pastor was on the boat. And I talked to him, and I said, are you worried about this? And he said, well, I'm very concerned. Yes, I am very concerned about the repercussions of what happened today. He said, it's just so inconvenient. I said, it's so inconvenient. This isn't hardship. No, it's just inconvenient. And he said, especially if I go to jail. I mean, that's so inconvenient. I mean, I've got all this work to do and all the people, and we're just doing this course, you know, about this, that, and the other. And he said, it's just so inconvenient. And he was really irritated because it was so inconvenient. And I thought, wow, we get inconvenience and hardship all mixed up. And they have hardship, and they call it inconvenience. And that's like Paul. And I want to get to that position where the things that matter, matter, and the things that don't matter, don't. And when you think about all the things that matter to us, we ought to be ashamed of ourselves. When you're serving in ministry, you've got a lot to worry about. I'm not minimizing that one little bit. Please don't get me wrong. But you need to evaluate yourself, even now where you're sitting, and figure out on this. I was at Wheaton College doing a meeting this last year, and a young man said, I've just had a fascinating class. We had to write our own epitaph. I said, really? He said, yes. He said it was quite an exercise. We had to sit there and think, what would we want on our gravestone when we're gone? Now, if you had to write your own epitaph, what would it be? I love going around English graveyards because they have the most fascinating epitaphs. And Stuart and I do that if we have a chance. Sounds a bit morbid, but there I am in all the graves writing down, you know, because I'm a writer, all these epitaphs. People are looking at me. Here lies a man who went out of the world without knowing why he came into it. That's what it said. Would you like that on your grave? Here lies a man who went out of the world without knowing why he came into it. How sad. I love this one. It was a Puritan's grave, and the Puritans were very grave. Excuse me. Here lies Reverend so-and-so who served God without enthusiasm. Well, if you know anything about your church history, it was almost a sin to show any enthusiasm or joy or smile in the Puritan. And so this was a compliment. This is Stuart's favorite, and this wasn't on a gravestone. The hypochondriac's epitaph. I told you I was ill. Yes. And I wonder what mine will be. Here lies Jill Briscoe, who worried herself to an early grave. It could be, because I've struggled with worry all my life, and I don't want that on my gravestone. So before I get there, I've asked the Lord to give me victory and more victory in this whole area of obsessive worry, because it's chased me all my life. Don't know whether it started when I never slept in a bed, but only in an air raid shelter, and I was bombed night after night as a little girl. Maybe that's where it all comes from. But I tell you, I have lived my life worried. I've worried about everything. I worried I'd never grow up and get married. And then I got married, and I worried I'd never get to the church. I'd have an accident on the way and never marry Stuart. And then I got to the church, and I married Stuart, and then I worried I'd never have kids. And then I had kids, and I worried they'd fall into the washing machine and drown. And then I just started worrying, and now we have 13 grandchildren. I tell you, it has been a workshop all my life. What is worry? The word is anxiety that obsesses, or to be distracted or have a divided mind, and that's the problem. When you allow whatever it is, however big a concern, to obsess you, you are no good to yourself, to your family, to your congregation, to your children, to your husband, to anybody, or to yourself. And that's where you have to begin. This is not helpful to anybody. And if you're fond enough of yourself, you'll want to do something about it. Worry distracts us from the essentials. And it's the Martha syndrome, you know. Master, don't you care? She, that's her sister, she has abandoned the kitchen to me. And Jesus said, Martha, dear Martha, you're fussing far too much and getting yourself worked up over nothing. Only one thing is essential, and Mary has chosen it. It's the main course. It won't be taken away from her. He's playing on words. You're worried about many courses. She's cooking a 9-course dinner because she's Martha. And one course will do, said Jesus. And Mary is giving me the course that has nourished my soul, her attention. That's what I want. That's the food I want. That's the food I want from you. And so what Jesus is saying is it's the essential thing. Worry distracts us from what we consider the essentials. Cooking for the guests, the meal on time, that's what was driving her. It had to be on time. All these people needed feeding. It is a legitimate worry, but what does it matter? Next week, Jesus is going to go to the cross. And this is the last time he'll be in that home to explain it. And only Mary gets it. She's the only one. She sat at his feet and listened, and he said, I'm coming to die next week, and I'm going to be crucified, and she got it. So she prepared his burial because he said, I'm going to be crucified, and crucified people aren't buried. Unhook the body, the animals get it, put it in a shallow grave, finished. And she said, not Jesus. So she got the burial already. It was her little box, it was her gift. And she spilled it over his feet, and she buried him. And everyone was appalled, and Judas particularly, because he was the treasurer and kept the money. And he said, all this waste, this could have been sold and given to the poor. Given to Judas, that's what he meant. And Jesus said, leave her alone. She's burying me. She got it. She attended to the essentials. And yes, one course would have done. He didn't say, don't feed them. He said, you're so worried about overdoing the inessentials that the essentials are forgotten. So worry distracts us from what we consider the essentials are. We get it out of perspective, what really matters. Worry about the present situation takes our eyes off what the most important thing is. Worry disguises unbelief. Disguises unbelief, really, and trust. Paul said, imitate me, watch me handle worry. Can you say that to the people that follow you? Are you a leader that's so uptight, it's just like this to be around you. And they see you with a perpetual spiritual headache. And they've got one of their own, so they don't want to be there. Or are you the sort of serenity? Do you have the sort of serenity that you people just want to snuggle up and say, I need some of this, and rub off against you? I had a leader like that for 13 years in missions. Joan Thomas was, for me, the most perfect example, near perfect, on this earth, of someone with incredible pressure in her life, who walked through it so serene and so tranquil. It was just the biggest miracle of all in that work in which we're engaged with street work and street kids. And I remember just following her around, hoping that it would sort of rub off on me without me doing anything at all, which of course it doesn't. But I remember her stopping on the way to an extremely important thing. Somebody was committing suicide upstairs in our youth center. The message had come, so she was on the way to attend to this. And I was panicking, and I said, should I go and tell Major and Stuart, and should I get the men? Oh, no, she said, they're doing all these important things. We can handle this, Jill. Come on, let's, you know. And so we run on a bit, and somebody comes and tells her something. She stops. She looks at them. They're center stage in her thinking. I'm thinking, why is she stopping? Because this was important. She dealt with it. She went on. And I just looked at Joan Thomas and realized that she was at peace down below while everything was like this on the surface. And I remember saying to her after it was all over, teach me, Joan. Show me. And she just said what Paul said. Hang around me, Joan. That was not an incredibly arrogant statement. It was a very humble statement. Paul said, watch me, imitate me. I'll show you how to do it. And that wonderful senior missionary of mine took me along and allowed me to hang around her and learn. And that's what you should be doing for the people that follow you, for your committee. You should be able to look at your life, know that you are learning. You haven't arrived, but you're learning how to handle worry and concern and obsessive trouble in your life. And you should be able to say to them, I'll share what I'm learning with you. Stay close to me. Let me tell you. No, I haven't arrived. But this I can tell you. This helped me. That helped me. And you pass on to others around you as you lead. Worry denies us strength for today. It superimposes the future on the present and empties today of its strength. Wow, isn't that true? It's this perpetual uneasiness. Perpetual uneasiness. Now, the problem is, I do tomorrow. Do you do tomorrow? And that empties today of its strength. I worry about tomorrow that has not come in such a fashion I'm useless today. And this is where you have to begin to get hold of yourself. I love this paraphrase. Give your entire concern to what God is doing right now, says Jesus. And don't get worked up about what may or may not happen tomorrow. God will help you deal with whatever hard things come up when the time comes. And that first line, give your entire concern, Jill, to what God is doing now, 2 p.m., 3 p.m., 10 p.m., whatever. And don't worry about tomorrow. I wrote a piece about that in The Deep Places. Doing tomorrow has different challenges than doing today. I should know. I seem to have done tomorrow before I do today all of my life. This robs me of the strength for doing today. And I've noticed that in the deep places, it's always today. You can't go there tomorrow. It's the ever-living present. And that's good because each day has enough troubles of its own, Jesus said to me. He whom my soul loves was sitting still on the steps beside me. What happens if, I said, I told you to stop thinking about tomorrow, he said. But I can't. What if? Jill, you have to stop this. But the dreaded tomorrow is about to happen, Lord, and I just can't walk into it without having a contingency plan, or two or three. What if? Well, the problem is, if you engage in this sort of useless speculation, you will find yourself living in the day after tomorrow, he said, smiling gently. What do you mean? Well, you'll start by saying, what will happen if? Then you'll get into when if what happens tomorrow that you've convinced yourself will happen tomorrow, what then? And then your mind will jump to the next day and the next. And then you will believe the day after tomorrow will be worse than the day before and the next disaster. And I said, it's true, Lord. It's this deadly momentum. My apprehension grows. Well, most of your fears will never happen. Well, I jumped on that. I know, Lord, but though most will not, some of them will, won't they? You said so. In the world, you will have trouble. So what if the fears I most fear are the troubles you said I will have? What then? Stop it, he said. You've emptied today of its strength with all this worry. Well, that was true. I'd been near tears all the time. And I thought about my life earlier that week when the gardener came to ask me what I wanted to do with the flower bed. And before he came to the door, I'd been worrying myself sick about tomorrow. And so I opened the door and I just gazed at him uncomprehendingly. And he looked at me apprehensively and murmured, "We need to get to the weeds." That jerked me back to the reality of today. And I gazed beyond him to the weeds in the garden, and suddenly it was all too much, and I burst into tears. The poor man looked aghast. But I couldn't help it. I was out of ideas, having used them all up on worrying about what to do tomorrow. And I didn't know what to tell him to do about the weeds. And I'd been so busy living in the scenarios I convinced myself would follow my dark day, so I stood there weeping quietly. And the poor man backed away from me. This truly happened. He backed away from me, looking apprehensively over his shoulder at the weeds. He got in the middle of the garden patch, still looking at me, fell to his knees, and started getting out the weeds in the garden. I still stood there weeping. Well, I noticed the Lord was smiling, and I knew he was thinking about the gardener, too. He got a small smile out of me as I thought about the man telling his family about the crazy lady having a meltdown, and I relaxed a little bit, but only a little bit. Doesn't do to relax too much, you know. You need to stay tense so you can worry some more. "I will meet you around the corner of your tomorrow with your future in my hands," he reminded me. "We'll meet it together when it comes, and if it comes. That's all you need to know about tomorrow. Now, about the strength you will need for the worries of today." And then we talked long and earnestly. Doing tomorrow is exhausting, isn't it? Get tired inside. So you have to do today. You've only got today, right? Do today. Stop doing tomorrow. There is such a thing, of course, as good concern. And I've discovered that God can turn a paralyzing, obsessive worry into a manageable concern if I do my part. And part of that is my mind. Starts up here. Whatsoever things are good, true, etc. Starts with the mind. Read Lamentations 3, one of my favorite passages, because that's who I am. I love Job and Lamentations, and I write books on all these things, because I'm an obsessive worrier and a negative personality. And so in Lamentations 3, the first 16 verses are just about where I live. I mean, it's all black, it's all dark. God even himself, I've lost perspective. He looks like a bear that drags me from the path and strangles me. That's what it says. This is Jeremiah speaking, the great prophet. And if you read the first 16 verses, you'd think, who's writing this? And then you see the turn before those incredible words. Great is his faithfulness. God is true. God is good. God is just. God is God. He's God enough. Well, what happens to him? He's absolutely manic. First, he's in 16 verses here, and then he's exalting the Lord, relaxed, full of joy and hope, in a hopeless situation, incidentally. It's the mind. One little verse. It's the turning point. It's the key. He says, as I thought about all this stuff, first 16 verses, my heart was dying within me. I was depressed. I was down. Yeah. So this I call to mind. The word is very strong. I put another record in. I played another tape in my mind. And therefore, I have hope. It is of the Lord's mercies we're not consumed. His compassions, they never fail. He's good, he's faithful, he's just. What happened? He put another record in. And you've got to change the tape. And if you insist on thinking on the bad and the dreadful and the dirty and the terrible and the past and what you fear in the future that we'll probably never have, then what will happen to you is you will become paralyzed with fear. And as Paul says in this chapter, start with your mind. If you mind your mind, God will mind your heart. Get it? If you mind your mind, God, I promise you, will mind your heart. And he'll garrison it. That's the word. He'll put soldiers of grace and peace around your worries and your troubles, your heart that is just beating till it seems it will never stop. And he'll calm you down. It's like good cholesterol. There is such a thing, apparently, as good cholesterol. There's good concern. And it won't do you any harm. In fact, it can even do you good. It can even do you good if you keep it at the right level. Worry is Satan's tool. He wants you dead, basically. And so he can do it with worrying you to death. That's a little phrase you need to listen to. You can be worried to death, literally. Now, doctors tell us that. Worry brings on all sorts of physical diseases as well as mental disorders. And so Satan uses worry as a very, very good tool. I mean, he wanted to kill Paul, so he put him in prison, locked him up, so he couldn't do any more damage, and Paul ended up converting the entire Roman legion. That was not the devil's idea. Joseph and his brothers, they put him in a pit, and were going to leave him to die. And the devil thought this was terrific. And he ended up prime minister of Egypt, feeding a nation, keeping them alive. That was not the devil's idea. Onesimus, a slave of a Christian owner, ran away, got into trouble, ended up in jail, chained to the Apostle Paul. I love it. That was not the devil's idea. And this man, Onesimus, in the history books of the early church, features he became an instrument of God. And so the devil wants the evil, but God uses it even to bring the good, if we will cooperate. And if we will say, there is nothing can happen to me outside the will of God, therefore I have to settle into this, and God will settle me down in it, and then I'm free to be the instrument of his grace and peace. It says, don't worry over anything, whatever. That's Philip's, Jesus' words. And he's not going to give us a day off, incidentally. Can I just have one day without worrying or something to worry about? No. So every day of our life, we must fight this fear and worry. Just imagine if it was all gone. What would you do with your time? That's a nice thing to dream about. You know, if you didn't spend all this time worrying, count it up. Think what you could do. You could spend all this time praying for the world, or helping the poor, or doing something useful with your life. Sometimes worry is carrying tomorrow's load with today's strength, carrying 2 days in one. It's moving into tomorrow ahead of time. Build a little fence of trust around today. Fill the space with living work and therein stay. Look not through the sheltering bars upon tomorrow. God will help thee bear what comes of joy or sorrow. S.D. Gordon. Build a little fence of trust around today. Fill the space with living work and therein stay. Look not through the sheltering bars upon tomorrow. God will help thee bear what comes of joy or sorrow. Worry, in other words, is utterly useless. Never serves a good purpose, brings no good results. Deliberately refuse to worry about annoying things. Make a list of all the annoying things in your life. Get on your knees and give it to God and say, I refuse to worry. Now help me. Stick it on the fridge. And every time you begin, go to the deep place where nobody goes and say, I'm sorry. Because in the end, worry is sin. Whatsoever that is not of faith is sin. And I think that's helped me more than anything else. Because I don't want to hurt God. I don't want to sin. And if I'm worrying and that's sin, then I know what to do with sin. I can repent of it. I can say, I'm sorry. So be obedient. Don't worry, like Jesus said. Number two, sing your pain away. Use praise. Celebrate God. All day, every day. Rejoice in the Lord. Again, I say rejoice. Celebrate God. All day, every day. Revel in Him. That's the message. Are you celebrating God? You know, in Africa, they have a singing church. Think about African Christians, those of you that have had the opportunity to have them in your church or go yourself. They're a singing church. They sing their pain away. Yes, they do. When the Holocaust happened in Rwanda, World Relief went to Goma, where everybody that survived ran, most of them kids who'd seen their parents slaughtered in front of them and worse. And they gathered 1,000 orphans in a field in Goma. And that was our responsibility and our little piece of helping when that happened. And our worker literally walked around the camp at night and listened for the singing. And he heard the singing and knew that was the church. And so everybody that was singing in the field that night, he gathered into one corner of the field. And he found they were all believers because the African church, man, woman, and child, is a singing church. And he found the church, and that's where he began, ministering to them, helping them, and then those people and those kids began to help everybody else around them. A friend of mine, a missionary, I was with her years ago on a trail in an African place, and towards us there came a group of people. And as they came towards us, they were singing. And the missionary friend said to me, oh, they must be Christians. And I said, why? She said, because the African church is a singing church. She said, when somebody comes to my husband and wants to become a member of the church, he doesn't say, well, you need to join our membership class or whatnot. He says, tell me about this. And they don't say, I want to be a Christian, or I want to be a believer, or I want to be a Presbyterian, or I want to be a Methodist or a Baptist. They say, I want to sing. That's what they say. Because they know that's all they see and hear is singing, joy, and singing, praise. So they want to sing. They want to do that. How can you sing in Goma? Only God. I mean, how can you not sit there and worry the rest of your life away? Only God. Shape your worries into prayers. Shape your worries into prayers. I love that phrase. Instead of worrying, pray, it says. Shape your worries into prayers. Take your worry and turn it on its head. Okay? So you find a quiet place. You go to the deep place where nobody goes. You sit there in silence. Learn to use silence. We do not know what that means. We're beginning to investigate it in the church. People are very worried. What's everybody doing mystically, sitting there, you know, going off somewhere? I tell you, we need to discover and rediscover silence and use it. We haven't a clue. We fill the place with words or sounds. You can't even go to the bathroom in America without piped-in music. It's just, we've not got to be quiet. We've got to get rid of anything that makes us be still and silent, because we can't be with ourselves, can we? Silence is a very frightening thing. Solitude is a frightening thing, but you've got to learn solitude if you're ever going to get over worry and concern. And there you shape your worries into a prayer. You can't worry and pray at the same time. Try. It's impossible. Shape your worries into prayer. Let God know your concerns. And listen to this, again, the message. Before you know it, a sense of God, wholeness, everything coming together for good will come and settle you down. I love it. Before you know it, a sense of God, wholeness, everything coming together for good will come and settle you down. I did have that experience. I didn't do very well in India, but I did do well in Hungary when I sort of got kidnapped by a taxi driver in the middle of the night and taken off into the dark. And I hadn't a clue what was happening. And he said he didn't speak English, in perfect English. And I said, well, that was pretty good English. And he said, no, I don't speak English. So I said, where are you taking me? And he wouldn't answer me. And he said, half an hour. I said, what do you mean? I'm going to miss my plane. And he didn't answer me. And I couldn't do a thing. I was there, 4 a.m. in the morning, in this taxi, taken off into the field in Hungary, and the airport lights behind me. And God gave me not peace, actually, he gave me anger. That was a gift. And it got all my adrenaline going. And I just knew what to say and I knew what to do. And underneath the anger, there was peace. This sounds really weird, and I'm trying to explain what was happening here. But anyway, long story short, he was going to pick somebody up in the middle of the night, even though he knew that I would lose my plane. I was trying to get to Anne Graham Lotz in London to speak in Central Hall, in probably one of the biggest things of my life that I ever wanted to do, was to speak to my country and my people from the Royal Albert Hall platform. Because I left the country to come here. And sometimes that's hard. And this was my chance. And here I was, rushing away into the night. But on that journey, first of all, I was angry enough to know how to handle that young man. But I was at peace enough and cognizant of the fact that I had to give that up. And that's what I got. I got it. Okay, this is a workshop. Okay. I got to lay it down, Lord. Yeah, you got to lay it down, Jill. You mean I won't be at the Royal Albert Hall? Yeah, probably not. Okay. And it was a little struggle, but once that was laid down, I knew exactly what to do. Might not sound like it. I nearly strangled the young man. Literally. I put my hands around his neck. I am ashamed of doing this, but I'm telling you, being honest. And I shook him, and I said, get me back to the airport. Well, by now he'd picked up his girlfriend, which is what it was all about, who was standing in the middle of a field half an hour away from the airport. I figured I'd missed my plane anyway. But he turned around, he came back, and he was about to drop me off, but he said, I have to drop my girlfriend off. She works at the airport. And I said, oh, no. And I was able to think of something that made him turn around, which I am not going to share with you. And he did, and he dropped me at the airport, and I got the plane with 50 minutes to spare. But I do want you to know, I learned a lot of things, and one of the things I learned in that moment was, if you can't figure out what's happening, he will give you the wherewithal to cope with what's happening. He'll give you an idea. He'll give you enough self-confidence, or in my case, I think righteous anger, to deal with the situation. But he'll also give you that little nod. Hey, lay it down, lay it down, lay it down, lay it down. Want to be great? Be small. To be big for God, right? Same thing coming through all the time in my life. And the things I was worrying about, see it? The things I was worrying about didn't really matter. Does it matter who stands on the Royal Albert Hall and tells about Jesus? There were plenty of other people that could do that. Didn't have to be me. Could be somebody else who could probably do it a lot better than me, right? And could take two sessions instead of me taking one. Probably be a lot better. And you come to this release. It's fabulous. Peace, that's peace. Okay, if I get there, I get there. I don't get there, I don't get there. Peace that passes understanding. Shape your worries into prayers. Sing your prayers away. Let God meet your needs. Take charge of your thoughts and know the peace of mind. Peace that passes all understanding. And what I'd like to say and testify to is I am a long way away from getting a good epitaph on my gravestone. But I'm determined it will not be, here lies Jill Briscoe, who worried herself to death. I made a decision, and I know God's going to help me to fulfill all the things I want to be on my gravestone before it's all over.